So, when I'm not doing my favorite church work, I have another job. And that job has what we call an upside-down pyramid as its organizational chart. Rather than having the CEO and the leadership team at the top of the pyramid, it has an inverted or upside-down view of leadership. It starts with the customers, then the frontline associates of over 2,000 stores. And then there's a few more levels, and at the very tip is the CEO and leadership team. So that's the way the business is run, assuming that the customers are first. Pretty good. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it's a great way to start your organizational chart. So we're going to learn today that Christ is also going to provide an upside-down kingdom. You see, he's not going to say, you can have the royalty of my right or my left, because there is no royalty in either one of those positions. But you see, the disciples, once again, don't listen. It's like it's his third time to tell them of what's going to happen. And yet, James and John still ask. In Mark 10:35-45, Jesus and his disciples have one of the most memorable dialogues in the New Testament. In these 11 verses, Jesus emphasized the importance of humility and service. He insists that self-giving service is the only greatness that God recognizes. And only those who give of themselves for others will be the big winners for God. In many words, Jesus insists that we climb down from the ladder of greatness. In other words, we must sacrifice to serve others instead of ambitiously seeking to climb the ladder and attain greatness. Jesus reveals that he is the king of an upside-down kingdom. His rules go against the grain and what we in our world see and want. In the two verses just before today's scripture, Jesus, mind you, for the third time, talks about his looming death. They were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them. They were amazed, and those who followed were afraid. He took the 12 aside again and began to tell them what was to happen to him. And he said to them, "Look, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death. Then they will hand him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him and spit upon him, and they will kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise." Are the disciples listening? Are they not in the same space as Jesus? Have they not heard these words 3 times? James and John, the sons of Zebedee, approach him. They are 2 brothers who belong to Jesus' inner circle. These disciples are incredibly intimate with Christ. They alone were present for the healing of Jairus' daughter and the transfiguration when Jesus was glorified. James and John are also called the sons of thunder. These brothers have fiery personalities and a zeal for the Lord. They are doing what they think is the right thing. They are led to ask a rather presumptuous question. "Teacher, we want you to do whatever we ask of you." In other words, Jesus, we want this blank check. Would you mind just signing your name right here so that we can cash it? Now, you know, there's been kids in our lives. And I can't tell you how many times my son came to me, "Mommy, say yes, Mommy, say yes." I knew whatever he was going to ask me was not something I was going to readily say yes at. But that's what the disciples have done, these James and John characters. Write a blank check. Just sign it. I'll take it from there. It's easy to deposit it. Earlier in Mark's gospel, I preached about another situation where Herod gave a blank check. Remember? He said, "You can have anything you want up to half of the kingdom." Do you remember what happened? That resulted in his wife and daughter requesting John the Baptist's head be delivered on a platter. A blank check. Since Jesus is wise and shrewd, he asked James and John very pointedly, "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus cuts to the chase and makes the brothers cough up precisely what they want him to do. The brothers reply, "Grant that we may sit one on your right and one on your left in your glory." Because you see, he's the king, right? And he's going to be sitting in this high, prestigious place of glory. And one to the right and one to the left. The word "grant" in this, "so you shall grant what we wear, grant that we may sit." The word "grant" is an imperative verb of command. It's not a request. It's not like, "Would you please?" It's "give it to me." In other words, these brothers are commanding Jesus to sit at authority. I can imagine that we can relate to wanting to be in positions of power. I remember that when Mom drove us anywhere, she drove the car because Dad always drove, but he wasn't going with us, it left the other half of the front seat unoccupied. So what did we do? Between my brothers and I, which one of us thought of the word to yell, "Shotgun," would get to sit in the front seat, meaning that you were to sit in the place of honor, and the two lowlives would sit in the back seat. I would get so upset and never wanted to be considered a lowlife. I remember one time, at least a day before we were headed out with Mom, and I yelled, "Shotgun." A day before, my brothers took those as fighting words, saying that it's not fair. You can't do it a day before. It has to be done while you're walking to the car. I really don't remember how Mom handled the situation, but I do remember that it wasn't until after my older brother went off to college that I got the reign of the front seat. Too bad for little brother stuck in the back. In Mark 10:38a, Jesus says to their ambitious, seemingly cutthroat brothers, "You do not know what you are asking." God usually answers prayers in one of four ways. So God will answer your prayers with yes, no, wait, or you don't know what you're asking for. The answer to their request is behind door number four. You don't know what you're asking for. Most of us pray that way, don't we? We like to tell Jesus what we want. "Here's my list. Thy will be done." Remember that? Our slogan is, "Ask not what you can do for God, but ask what God can do for you." However, it's critical to note that Jesus doesn't rebuke James and John. He doesn't call them lowlives for being ambitious, nor does he reject them for having drive and desire. He is pleased that they desire the kingdom's greatness. That much is good. However, Jesus wants to explain the biblical ambitions need to be transformed into humility, directed towards serving others rather than a proud serving of oneself. He wants these brothers to understand the need to climb down the ladder to greatness. So Jesus warns them of what will be involved in their quest for the kingdom's greatness. He explains that greatness always involves suffering. Jesus asks, "Are you able to drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism for which I am baptized?" Cocky James and John, they say, "Yes, we can, we will." The analogy of the cup and the word baptism were used figuratively in the ancient world, and they meant suffering. Jesus asked these two brothers if they can suffer the same suffering he prepares to enter into. In other words, Jesus asked James and John if they can handle the cross. Jesus was crucified with a thief on his right and a thief on his left. Yet James and John didn't ask to be one of those crosses. They wanted only the cross of greatness. They wanted the crown on their heads. They wanted recognitions, not crucifixions. Yet the disciples must concentrate on present service rather than future honor. James and John confidently affirm, "We are able." These brothers assume that they can endure all the suffering that Jesus might have to endure. Because you see, they knew it all. They know what's going to happen because they've been listening, right? Because they didn't understand the full ramifications of what Jesus was going to go through and what Jesus had predicted. They were thinking of a military or a political greatness. As a result, these two brothers are self-confident. Kind of like Muhammad Ali. Ali was on a plane preparing for takeoff when a flight attendant asked him to buckle his seatbelt. Ali said to her, "Superman don't need no seatbelt." The flight attendant quickly answered, "Superman don't need no airplane either." If we're honest too, we exclude the kinds of overconfidence at times. Yet we might call it in mind, kind of like Paul's writing that he writes in Rome, "Do not think of yourself more highly than you ought. And therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall." And that's in Corinthians. We must recognize our deep-seated need to depend on Christ. Before all this resentment escalates into a full brawl between the disciples and James and John, because the disciples are not happy with James and John, Jesus gathers them all together, just like Jesus did. And he opens his arms and he says to them, "You know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles, Lord is over them. And their great men exercise authority over them, but it is not this way among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you will be slave to all." In these three verses, Jesus expounds on his upside-down kingdom. It's an upside-down kingdom. On February 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. delivered a sermon on this text. The sermon was called "The Drum Major Instinct." And he delivered this at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. The sermon was delivered only 2 months before his assassination. His sermon was on the exact text that we read today. In it, Dr. King speaks to his congregation about the destructive forces of the drum major instinct, defined as the desire to be first, to be recognized, and to receive distinction. Reverend King laid the framework for his 40-minute sermon. Aren't you guys lucky? By defining the drum major instinct. And it's a desire to be out front, a desire to lead the parade, a desire to be first, and the need to be important, to surpass others, to achieve. I want to be the drum major. King emphasizes the importance of reordering our priorities as the true path to distinction and greatness by being first to love. This meant using our drum major instinct for the right priorities, serving others, justice, peace, and economic equality. The quote from the drum major instinct, he says, "We all have the drum major instinct. We all want to be important, to surpass others, to achieve distinction, to lead the parade. And the great issue of life is to harness the drum major instinct. It is a good instinct if you don't distort it, or pervert it. It is a basic human impulse for recognition. Yet the drum major instinct can turn into a pernicious, dangerous, unharnessed instinct. It can cause one's personality to be distorted. If it isn't harnessed, he warns, you will end up day in and day out trying to deal with your ego problem by boasting." Everything around us seems to encourage us to seek power and position. Whether we look at school, in our jobs, with our family or friends, or on the media, all seem to tell us that taking first place, you know, because second place is first loser. We all want to take first place. Having authority, wealth, and status should be our ambition, right? If we are honest with ourselves, we will admit we are happy to listen and follow that message. Everything around us sends us towards power and position, except for one thing: the cross of Christ. The gospel turns worldly values upside down. We have seen those served by the Great One. He served us even to the point of giving his life for us in death. The greatest truth compels us to reassess our lives and our ambitions. We have discovered what life is about when we serve others as Jesus did. Amen.